Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Symmetry of Soul, in-depth web-based study of the Urantia Book for able and willing students. Tonight, paper 165, section 6. We're in the picturesque land beyond the Jordan, virtually following after Jesus during his last ministry work in the flesh. And there's a lot of conversation about money, and a lot of conversation about wealth. Some things never change, it seems. What a transcendent service if through this revelation the Son of Man should be recovered from the tomb of traditional theology and be presented as the living Jesus. That's what we're trying to do, make this relevant to our lives today, of course. I'm Brad Garner. I'm so glad that you've joined us here Tuesday evening or in our archive at symmetryofsoul.org. Who do we have here tonight? We've got Justin Armstrong filling in for Andrea Barnes. We have Kermit Anderson. And, of course, Dr. Chris Halverson is here as our teacher as we try to be the able and willing students. And we have you. Please call up the text of the Urantia Book by paper or electronic means and settle in with us for this 1% of the week where we try to figure out our place in the cosmos, especially with this special planet that we're on and this special bestowal that we're studying here yet again. Good evening, Dr. Chris.
Good evening, Brad. And hello, Justin. Thank you much for stepping in. And hello, Kermit, and everyone listening. And I just couldn't help but think when you brought up, about recovering the genuine Jesus from all the enshroudment that he's been in for the last 2,000 years. It's not only a theologic blanket that he's been hidden under. As we'll see again here tonight, it's secular blankets that Luke had a lot to do with, that he's been hidden under as well, that we need to recover him from.
That's a really illuminating point, Dr. Chris. You're bringing an angle of studying this that certainly I've never found myself and never heard anyone else sort of point out about in what ways were the various gospel accounts of Jesus, in very specific ways, were they filtered through the different lenses of those writers. And Luke is very prominent in our discussions right now. So looking forward to more of that. And Justin, good evening to you. So glad that you're here with us again. How are you doing out your way?
I'm well, Brad. Just really grateful to be here with everyone. Hi, Chris. Hey, Kermit. And looking forward to tonight's show.
Yeah, thank you for being able and willing, to fill in here this evening. We're glad that you're here. And we're glad that all of you are there in the chat room. We see some of our regulars in there, and we say hello to them. And now I say good evening to Kermit Anderson. And Kermit, what have you got up your sleeve for us?
Hi there. Well, I've shook it out of my sleeve and put it online here. And we'll go ahead and sally forth into a little recap of last week. The continuing topic of riches and the love thereof, covetousness, prompted a deeper look at the actuality dynamics, the physics, of the threefold system of cosmic reality. Essentially, genuine sixth level of meaning love is engagement in the uppermost regions of the inner life with spirit energy, abstracting and elevating the covetous desire for riches to the higher realms of the spiritualized mind is most inimical to soul growth and spirit perception. Commentary ensued pertaining to the purpose of the inclusion by the midwares of commonplace details when setting the scene for their narrative. For example, the role of rainfall in determining their teaching schedule at the Pelican. Such a technique adds a richness to the account and also helps to disabuse the reader of picturing Jesus as the supernatural magic man possessed of powers over the forces of nature, in favor of his being a normal human being subject to the natural environment. Note, all of this in light of the early church's almost complete disregard for Jesus' humanity, evinced by the fact that they only began celebrating his birth in the 4th century A.D. We began our reading in the middle of section 4, dividing the inheritance of paper 165. It is significant that the midware narrative closely parallels the New Testament Gospel of Luke. Yet, as we are accustomed to discovering, the Revelation with its authoritative elimination of error and coordination of essential knowledge provides details exposing the olden records as being virtually 180 degrees diametric to the Master's true teachings. The opening passage of our reading, Jesus did not teach nor countenance improvidence, idleness, indifference to providing the physical necessities for one's family or dependence upon alms, can be seen as a disclaimer of the erroneous ideas perpetuated through the centuries that his followers are to divest themselves of their material possessions and give the proceeds to the poor. In all his teaching, Jesus always prioritized soul growth and spiritual progress over the material and temporal details of living. Even today, the term spiritual is routinely misapplied to matters temporal. The religion of the spirit is still a relatively rare commodity in today's world when compared with the religions of the mind. Further entreaty by the covetous young man elicited a veritable barrage of scripture passages from the master on the nature and consequences of avarice. He sends the young man away with one of his oft-repeated invitations for reflection. What shall it profit you if you gain the whole world and lose your own soul? This section concludes with further invitation for reflection concerning how the wealthy shall stand in the day of judgment, with three questions pertaining to their wealth. How much did they accumulate? How did they get it? And how did they use it? We read, went on to section 5, talks to the apostles on wealth. Inasmuch as the apostles were busy baptizing believers while Jesus spoke to the young man, Andrew requested that Jesus repeat his teaching for the benefit of the 12. Here's where things get interesting. Luke failed to distinguish the instruction which Jesus intended for his apostles from that which applied to disciples and believers. It was for the apostles only that he uttered the famous, "Consider the lilies of the field and consider the ravens," reminding them that the things of the temporal life would be supplied without their worry. He went on to make clear that the disciples and believers bore the responsibility for earning their own bread and contributing to the sustenance of those who teach, preach, and heal. As mentioned last week, Luke's gospel added to Jesus' watchword, "Fear not," the threat of going to hell. This week, we note two more blunders Luke saw fit to imprint upon Christianity. The admonition attributed to Jesus apparently instructing his followers to sell their possessions and give the proceeds to the poor was the product of Luke's own bias. Back in paper 140, section 8, paragraph 17, the midwares identify Luke's strong beliefs in social equality as the reason for this inclusion concerning the redistribution of wealth. The section ends with Jesus warning of his impending departure about 2 months hence, whereas Luke represents Jesus as returning in an hour least expected and in an unexpected manner. The effect of this proclamation was to greatly delay the writing down of records of Jesus' life and teachings, inasmuch as he was supposed to soon return. Well, Luke, that makes three pretty big ones. Fear of going to hell, sell all your stuff for the benefit of the poor, and now Jesus will be right back. Well, here ends my summary, and we can continue this adventure.
Thank you. Thank you, Kermit. I think that that's the first time in my memory where you actually address one of the apostles sort of in that tense. Well, Luke. Well, no, I say that. I think you've done that before with like Bertrand Russell or something. Sorry, Bertrand. Sorry, Bertie.
I may have. I restrain myself, though. There are many others I would have loved to.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can't give him some slack since, you know, you could say precisely an apostle in the 12 sense.
Right.
But of course, yeah.
But still, yeah.
Pretty close to the event at hand, of course. Yeah. But, you know, we mentioned last week this light chuckling that we have at either the apostles or the, you know, the people, the immediate successors, and just shaking your head like, boy, they just didn't get it. We're really kind of chuckling at ourselves. If you were in Luke's position, would you have done better? Would you have avoided putting your own fingerprints and political biases on things as you heard them? Like, that's the way that our material mind works. You would have had to have been a skilled philosopher, the best of your generation, to check your biases there. So, you know, it happened the way it happened.
I guarantee you, if Luke is listening right now on high, I mean, he would want nothing more from us than you know, for us to learn from, you know, his immaturity.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's like, you know, he's thinking, well, at least I'm a great point of reference going forward. It's like, you know, what seemed like a good idea at the time, right? Yeah, not so much. and it is, it's a very interesting fact that the midwayers, you know, so definitively want us to reflect on this indirect lesson that we can gain from Luke. Because, you know, it's a little mustard seed that is, you know, beginning to become quite a large tree now, 2,000 years later. I mean, for instance, you know, we were pondering during the broadcast last week of all the, you know, countless things that Jesus said that the midwayers don't include in part four. You know, sometimes telling us that, man, this is a fantastic thing he said, you know, and then they don't tell us what he said. You know, and then we were saying, well, yeah, and then in contrast to that, which was apparently like really, really amazing, and they didn't tell us, you know, they give us this little sidetrack on, you know, this guy that's all wrapped around the axle about his inheritance and his brother is getting more than, quote unquote, his fair share and yada yada. It's like, well, wow, what, I mean, why spend so much time holding that up, right? I mean, yeah, it's got to be more than just, well, you know, Luke's got some things about that, so we need to clear that up.
Hmm.
You know, so you can ask yourself the question, why did they hold up this little vignette that Jesus had with this guy and you know, so definitively clarify that Jesus is trying to get him to recognize that what's really motivating him is not what he thinks is motivating him. Right, but, you know, the lad is very much, consciousness is very much on the surface of himself, you know, and thinks, you know, I'm sure he's sincere that, you know, that really what's going on with him is it's just this, you know, this sort of legal issue, you know, like Jesus says, do you not know that the Jewish laws of inheritance will be justly administered, et cetera?
Yeah,
you know,
right.
You know, why are you coming to me about this stuff? Go to the synagogue. Right, but Jesus tries to get, you know, and he finally, when he, as we talked about, brings out the double-barreled shotgun and really, you know, goes at the kid, try to get him to punch through that sort of self-confusion, you know, and recognize what's really motivating him deep down is covetousness. You know, there is a spiritual element here, and it's definitely not, you know, the coins of the inheritance.
Right.
The spiritual element is in this individual, you know, who hasn't recognized that he has twisted his spiritual nature, and he doesn't recognize that he's done that because he has this unfortunate rationale on the surface that he is conscious of. And he thinks, oh, I'm in the right here. Well, okay, so again, why highlight this? Because, you know, this kind of combines together with Luke's blind spot, Luke's fixation. All right, we go all the way forward to today. And, you know, we could talk in many ways. Let's just, you know, let's just maybe keep it immediately on that I brought up what Brad said at the beginning about, you know, the theological blanket over Jesus. Like, well, what about the secular one? What about, you know, the growing tendency for religion to not just kind of naturally be set by theologic difficulties,
mm-hmm.
but bounding itself away from you know, any sort of genuineness of religion, you know, totally, you know, and just becoming all about social justice. Right? Luke was this social justice warrior. He was that specific flavor of a progressivist. Right? The midwayers are wanting you to think about the vignette of Jesus and the lad with his inheritance, you know, and Luke's social justice agenda. Put the two together. I mean, and for people to ask themselves, okay, is it really what you tell yourself why you want to redistribute wealth? Or is there something deeper that's your issue, that the rich person doesn't really have the issue because he's greedy, quote-unquote? Maybe you have forgotten that thou shalt not covet.
Yeah.
They're trying to get you to put those two together. Right? Because that is relevant to our times. Right? We recognize that if sort of outer life issues are confused, okay, well, that's problematic, but that probably wouldn't be an emergency, you know, that would mobilize super universe celestials to try to help us. It's got to have something to do with the inner life being corrupted.
Covetousness.
Not just
yeah.
the outer life being, you know, ignorant, confused, you know, whatever. Right, and it is. I mean, people need to take a deep breath and examine themselves, quit working themselves up into a lather about how much money that guy over there has and how unfair that is, and you know, ask themselves, it's like, wait a minute, maybe I'm the real problem here. Because real problems are tied to spirit. Right? That guy's greed is probably, you know, just superficial, material, you know, fancy raccoon greed. Raccoons don't have spiritual problems, no matter how much stuff they
yeah.
steal and hoard. Right? So, you know, the truth of the revelation is found when you begin to synthesize, right? You've got these little elements that are given. There's this element and there's this element. You go, well, I don't know why those two elements are here together, whatever, and you go on to the next element. It's like, no. Is there a synthesis awaiting you there? And in that synthesis is a truth that transcends the historical moment and the specific circumstances?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thou shalt not covet. Now, so it's one thing to appropriately try to address issues of social injustice. Okay? But the problem comes when your twisted inner life that you've left unreflected, and hence it's twisted, begins to energize these outer life efforts, you know, that should be just about material pragmatism, right? And you give them a false spiritualization within yourself that you don't even recognize.
I mean, in in fairness, or just to counterbalance it, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I'm hearing you say, Chris, is, you know, he's addressing those who are not of great material riches and the fact they can have covetousness in their heart. There are plenty of other times where he calls out the people who have great riches and they have put those inside, you know, their heart. I mean, mm-hmm. Pharisees, yep. Some of the Sadducees, they're there because sure. of wealth. I mean, he calls them out too. It's like the problem is an outer life being implanted, issue being put in the heart, no matter what your station in life is.
Right. See, so you have to be discriminating, right? You have to ask yourself, okay, this little vignette about wealth, is that the issue, you know? Or not? Jesus is trying to point out, I mean, this isn't some massively rich person's, you know, so that you're going, you know, you're needing to analyze that situation.
Right.
The whole issue of the actual inheritance is irrelevant in this situation, Jesus is trying to point out. It's like, forget about that. You have a serious inner life problem.
Right?
That's what he's trying to tell him. You need to get to that. Right? The other stuff we can take care of. But your inner life issue, you know, has consequences to your soul. Whether you die a pauper or not doesn't.
Some of these thoughts occurred to me a few years ago when I was the executor of my father's estate. And in reading about all the approaches to handling that, I read stories of families that were completely ruptured, torn asunder over, you know, $5,000. My goodness, that sounds like only Spirit Energy could have. I mean, that's just, I know that's a lot of money to some people, but you've ruined a family over that. Well, congratulations.
Yeah, right.
What
well, you know,
it
the
profit
other
that you one might say,
right? Yeah. Is that really profit?
If you gain the 5,000 but lose your soul,
yeah.
And you know, this covetousness is certainly highlighted and showcased in what we've been doing the last couple of weeks. But there's a handmaiden to covetousness in the material comfort era that is really scattered throughout the book, the whole problem, and I think it's one of the major emergencies that's cited by the authors, is the whole self-gratification out of control problem. And that's tied to covetousness because getting all that stuff means you can do whatever you want and you can indulge in whatever you want. So,
great point. You know, and see, to better understand why they talk so much about the problems of self-gratification, you know, and you can recall, if you think about all the things they say, okay, just as long as it's just the immediacy of, you know, some appropriate material comfort, there's no issue. The issue is if you drag it up and in and spiritualize this.
Yeah, like they say,
you know,
we
so that
we've
it has this energy behind it that, you know, it should not have.
Yeah, I mean, we've done the paper 84, but 84, section 8, the great threat against family life is the menacing rising tide of self-gratification, the modern pleasure mania. That they're really striking a blow there throughout
See,
the revelation.
Why would it be rising? Hasn't there been really greedy people forever?
Yeah.
See, what's different? See, you know, we're more spiritualized now, and unwittingly, right, we are corrupting, you know, our super conscious, mostly inner life. You know, and it not only puts an energy that's destructive into the outer life issues, but, you know, let's just think about yourself first. What's that doing to your soul? When the nucleus of your inner life is some material issue instead of God.
Sure. And
you're
then
just,
the religious
copies that into your soul.
Yeah. Yeah.
A less God-nucleated Marantia object. Is that what you want to wake up with on the first mansion world?
Yeah, and then you get the religious revolution or the ecclesiastical revolution against self-gratification. So it's actually become all evil and must be subjugated. So here are the horsehair shirts and some whips for you guys. Go in there and get busy.
Right. Yeah, the time-honored, you know, asceticism stuff, you know, that, see, which just reminds you, okay, yeah, see, there's always been that, you know, that a glorified raccoon problem. Yeah, that started with Anna Infanta, okay? I mean, maybe not them individually, but, you know, clear back then, right? Okay. From day one, right, there's been individuals who've had that weak point, right? And their group, their society had to deal with their antisocial tendencies because of that self-absorption. You know, that's always been there. Right? But as you just read, you know, they're telling you there's some new energization of this. Right. And that's because, right, the evolutionary process has been dragging us forward, and we more and more unwittingly bring a spiritualization of issues into play to the detriment of those around us because we're ever more fanatical, and to the eternal detriment of ourselves.
Yeah, and, let alone our society and our civilizational structures.
The more you make that Morantia object identified with time, the less it's potentially immortal.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as I often do, yeah, let's just start with that favorite object that you have, yourself. Okay? Right? Let's seem to just consider it selfishly for a moment, right? And throw our altruism aside. It's like, yeah, what about yourself, right? If you're so fixated on yourself, let's get serious about that. Right? What about what the damage you're doing of yourself's relationship to eternity by spiritualizing material temporal affairs?
Yeah.
Chris, I can't help but think about when you're talking about this synthesis of, on one hand, social justice tendencies, and on the other hand, a distorted inner life. I can't help but think of an individual who on the surface is claiming that they're trying to do good, but underneath there's this deep resentment towards wealthy individuals that's motivating the act of supposedly doing good or social justice. I can't help but think of that word resentment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's like, you know, a lot of times there's just a very thin coat of white paint covering up that fact.
Yeah.
Right. They're coveting. Right. You know, they say they want that guy's wealth for that person over there. Okay, that's what you tell yourself. Yeah, so, you know, again, it's just, you know, it's easy to see when someone seems to be awfully animated about this. They seem to be taking this personally. Yeah, see, that's my point. They're dragging it in and up into that part of their mind that's their personalized self. Of spiritualized mind, right, which should not have to do with such matters.
Right.
That should be about your relationship to spirit and eternity, not your relationship to matter and to time.
Huh. Yeah.
Right. You've got another half of your mindal self, the lower domain in the hourglass analogy, that's designed to handle the material and the temporal. Is supposed to handle it, designed to handle
right.
it, is appropriate
right.
when it handles it. Nothing evil about it, as it should be. Right, but what about the other part that's supposed to be about something in contrast to time and in contrast to matter? What about that? I don't have time for things like that.
time. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Soon you will have no time. It is, if you have no eternity, then you have no time.
Yeah, right.
You will be as if you had never been.
Huh. So that's why they're bringing all this up. It's relevant to right now. It was relevant 2,000 years ago, but it's amped up now.
Yeah,
and it's why the book is here. The things that are in the book are why the book is here. That's pretty much ipso facto.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the book isn't here because that boy 2,000 years ago had issues of coveting.
Right.
No,
so we can read it now and be like, boy, am I glad I'm not like that guy back then.
Yeah.
Why was he clueless? Yeah, that's not why the book is here, right, to bolster our self-righteousness.
Although if you want to do that, it's very handy for that.
Oh, there isn't a better text ever printed.
Exactly.
To exalt yourself with.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, not only can you exalt yourself with every sentence in it, you know, comparing against this person and that person, but then you can take the whole book as an object and beat other people over the head about it, saying, haven't you read this? I have. Like you can lump it or split it, either way. Yeah.
You could go to Ermia, right? Lord it over others. Right. And we'll see, right, you know, that there's a natural bedfellow to covetousness, and that's self-righteousness, like I just brought up. That will come up tonight. It's not a coincidence that we'll be talking about self-righteousness this evening. Now, building upon the coveting foundation here. All right.
Sure. Shall we roll forward?
Yeah, shall we roll on? Anything else, Kermit or Justin? Any other thoughts?
No, I'm good.
No, I'm good.
All right. Yeah, speaking of the reading ahead of us, let's get into it. It's paper 165 of the Urantia book, The Perean Mission Begins. We're at section 6, Answer to Peter's Question. Interesting non-specific title, but let's find out what it was.
Well, it's specific because it's a break point in the Gospel of Luke, right? I mean, he pauses, has this same intro, like we have a little intro, and then we get into Jesus again. So, yeah.
So,
it's Peter's question in the book of Luke.
There we go.
12th chapter.
Okay. good to always remember the parallels, yeah.
Yep.
It's page 1824 of the original single-column text of the Urantia book. Okay. As they sat thinking, Simon Peter asked, "Do you speak this parable to us, your apostles, or is it for all the disciples?" And Jesus answered.
And just one little thing to tee that up. You know, even though, like Kermit reminded us, you know, Luke not being as clear on this as he could have been, it comes back around here. But the issue is, you know, what we just finished with, as Jesus was, you know, quote-unquote, you know, repeating these words for our benefit, right, for the apostles' benefit, he threw in a parable at the end. I had that parable about the master that leaves and the servants waiting for the master to come back. You know, after all, the fact that he's got the parable with the master coming back, he can't be too hard on Luke and others flipping it. You know, Jesus is speaking, using that parable where he's departing, even though the master, quote unquote, in the parable is coming. Okay. And, you know, such subtleties, you know, went right over most listeners' heads. But,
yeah.
See, it's specifically, you know, the fact that he threw a parable in there, You know, and so Peter is thinking, oh, okay, another parable. Is this parable meant for, you know, for just us or for others? You know, can we use this in our preaching? Okay, so you see that Jesus appreciates that. You know, he doesn't go, well, I told you up front, you know, that this is about you, right? He appreciates that Peter isn't being totally dense. Okay. And when Luke does this, you know, he has this, you know, this basic distinction, you know, Lord, are you telling this parable to us or to everyone? Okay. All right, so, you know, and you can see here, you know, Peter saying, do you speak this parable? All right, so there's, you know, Luke is on the same page here as what really happened, and Jesus doesn't, you know, start wagging his finger at Peter. He wants to, you know, help to clarify, you know, the specific issue of the parable. How general is it?
Yeah. But as usual, you know, let's see what Jesus' reply is. It's always at least one level removed from the immediacy of the question.
Of course, yes.
What's really being asked?
I can imagine. Yeah, just jump in. After Jesus has a whole bunch of things, Peter's still thinking, okay, so what's the answer to my question, Jesus?
Yeah, right.
Why was it not a one-word answer? Dummy? Or two words? You, dummy? Yeah. No. In the time of testing, a man's soul is revealed. Trial discloses what really is in the heart. When the servant is tested and proved, then may the Lord of the house set such a servant over his household and safely trust this faithful steward to see that his children are fed and nurtured. Likewise, will I soon know who can be trusted with the welfare of my children when I shall have returned to the Father. As the Lord of the household shall set the true and tried servant over the affairs of his family, so will I exalt those who endure the trials of this hour in the affairs of my kingdom.
You can kind of see, it's like, well, okay, I'm really just talking to you guys still specifically.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, obviously you can always extrapolate beyond the immediacies, you know, but... yeah, he's trying to, really sober them up directly. Look at the, it's like, you think that as my apostles, you go forward with all kinds of rights. No, you go forward with responsibilities.
No.
I'm about to see which ones of you can be trusted with the welfare of my children. And he probably had a dramatic pause where he put his finger out and scanned it across the 12 of them.
Oh, dear. Not that, please.
You, Kermit? You, Brad?
And then he always throws in that little reminder about returning to the Father. It's getting close.
Right. Yep.
Still, though, I'm having a little trouble figuring out how he's even slightly answering Peter's question. I'm just trying to figure out what the connection is.
Yeah, well, that's what I was saying. I mean, I was hinting at it there, but I mean, see, he doesn't. He's wanting them to reflect.
Right.
And he's not giving them the easy out of just a direct answer. So that's just an important thing to notice. Now, in terms of generalization, look at how he starts. See, I mean, he gives them the first thing he says definitely goes beyond the apostles.
It's one of the most general things that it's a timeless, universal.
Yes, in the time of testing, a man's soul is revealed. Trial discloses what really is in the heart. Right, and see, in case you were thinking Maranja object when they said soul, no, they repeated and said heart. Okay, so we mean soul in the sense of the upper domain, the heart. Okay,
mm-hmm.
And see, you know, that's, do you have an unnatural framing of your mind or not? Right, it's difficult, you know, in pleasant times to figure that out. But if I put you to the test, I can quickly figure it out. Ah, that's a natural response to that stimulus. Oh, that's not. Interesting. Right?
No.
I mean, you technically have an upper domain, but do you effectively have an upper domain?
Yeah.
Or are you effectively just a fancy animal that reacts to stimuli based upon the framing, the biologic framing of the lower domain of your mind? Someone taps your knee with a rubber hammer and ta-da!
Reflex.
All right. Is there anything there besides that? Yeah. Could you be replaced by a properly programmed automaton?
Well, you know, much of life is machine-like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But is all of your life machine-like? Yeah.
Yeah, is effectively all of it? That's the question, right? You're not being judged on how much isn't, right? It's okay. But is there effectively some part that is? I mean, you know, it may be so small that I can't pick it up in, like I said, pleasant times. But, you know, can I even pick it up in trying times?
Yeah.
I mean, do you dig deep ever? Right, so, see, I mean, in a way he's saying, you know, is it for just the apostles or for the disciples as well? And Jesus answers, yes.
Right.
Right. If you know how to properly reflect on what I'm saying, you know what's for you and what part you can take beyond yourself. And I expect you to be able to do that. Right? You know, and, you know, as I bring up all the time, I mean, the entire Urantia book is written that way. Right? Where, you know, it's not pedantic.
Yeah.
Right? You have to properly parse it. You know, and if you don't have the tools to do that, you'll get nothing but error from the book. That's just the way it is. Because that's the way life is. You know? Life doesn't spoon-feed truth to you. You have to abstract it apart. Right? And it takes, you know, very advanced cosmic machinery in your mind to do that. If you don't have that machinery, you get nothing but error from your life.
Well, just putting a couple of ideas quickly together here. I you were saying, as we were talking about, there are so many things that are not in the Urantia book that happened. I was just earlier today reading the paper 137, Tarrying Time in Galilee. And there's a section that says, oh, and so then they spent 4 months and they had like nightly sessions where they were talking and asking questions at Jesus' feet. And the apostles looked back later in life and said, that was a very profitable time for us. And they don't tell us anything else about those times. They don't tell us any of the stories, any of the questions, the training sessions. Maybe those early times were where the apostles were exposed to more direct answers to their direct questions, you know, sort of getting the foundation built. But here Jesus is near the end of his mortal life, and he's giving them very, you have to pull this apart and figure it out for yourself because soon I won't be here kinds of answers to questions.
Yeah.
And they're, in turn, the ones they're giving to us because we have to figure this out because Jesus is not here with us.
Yeah, I mean, there's no prince and his staff here. There's no Adam and Eve and crew here. There's no one here. You got to figure this out yourself.
Yeah.
Now, if you do, you get recognized for that, Mr. Agendonter.
Right.
But, Not if it's too sad to record. Again, the sad to record thing is about having that cosmic machinery where you can discriminate, reflectively engage your life, your experiential life, you know, and find the truth therein rather than just the immediacy, that, which is all error.
So I can't help but think of the, in terms of the second sentence, when the servant is tested and proved, I can't help but think of the Matthew principle, for unto everyone that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance, but from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, and that, right now, we you know, by grace, all of us from age six, right, have an upper domain, superconsciously, that we have a relationship to truth. But it's 100% to begin with, superconscious. Right? If it wasn't so, as you moved into relationship with truth, the first step would be obeying truth or not. But no, that's the second step. The first step is knowing truth or not.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't start out knowing truth. I mean, assuming that you start out knowing truth, that's the third principle of the Lucifer Manifesto. So that you think it's just an issue of obeying or not. And of course, you know, by definition, what you do is right, so you're obeying the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so you quickly go from assuming the first step to also assuming the second step.
Amazing how often that comes up. Yeah.
Yeah. So, right, this is, you know, this is, it's very important to disabuse yourself of the notion that, oh, well, I started out long ago knowing the truth, and I'm still working on obeying it. No. That's a thing called pride. Yeah. Where's the humility? Start with a ruthless challenge to yourself. I know not truth. But I'm going to supply the favorable conditions, and I'm going to trust that I will be grown into truth. But right now, I know I'm not there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Beginning to understand why all that stuff I found distasteful, like, oh, these people groveling, saying, Lord, I'm sinful, I'm worth nothing, Jesus, don't even look at me. I'm beginning to understand why that can actually have its place and have value. It gets overplayed and gets into old-timey stuff, but, yeah, it certainly is humility, if it's sincere, if it isn't just repeating magic phrases. Yeah.
Think about, you know, some just run-of-the-mill beliefs you have in life, you know, it's secular issues. You know, and ask yourself a probing question. Why do you find your ignorance so authoritative?
Well, there you go.
It's like a glove, man.
I mean, if you really can, you know, think about that for a second. No, don't. I mean, see, there is an answer for that. You have identified unquestioningly with some established authority. Your belief is not your belief, it's their belief that you've adopted. Right? That's why, mm-hmm. See, in your ignorance, you have such an authoritative sense of yourself. See, it's that simple thing. Yeah. Intellectual assent, credulity, and established authority. That's why you find your ignorance so authoritative. And the revelation is here to try to snap you out of that. Because at some point, it's not cute anymore.
It's harmful, yeah.
It's destructive to civilization. You are the destroyer of worlds.
Good laughing because of the reference. Thank you.
Yes. It's not. It's not just Oppenheimer that can invoke. Hindu lines. Yeah. Yeah, I mean that season, I mean, appreciate that. I mean, that's when you get going to get really serious about why the book is here. I mean, this is the kind of, that's what it's saying deep down between the lines, right? That there are individuals who are just the philosophic destroyers of civilization on this world. Are you one of them? Who, me, Lord?
Boy, oh boy, the more we get into this, the less certain I am that I know how to give anything like a 5-minute synopsis. So what is this Urantia book anyway? It's about God's love. It's about God's love. Oh, is it really? Okay.
Yeah, it's not about, the Apostle John the Centurion. You know what I mean?
Philosophic text. All right.
Yeah, anyway.
Okay. But if the servant is slothful and begins to say in his heart, my master delays his coming, and begins to mistreat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunken, then the lord of that servant will come at a time when he looks not for him and, finding him unfaithful, will cast him out in disgrace. Therefore, you do well to prepare yourselves for that day when you will be visited suddenly and in an unexpected manner. Remember, much has been given to you. Therefore will much be required of you. Fiery trials are drawing near you. I have a baptism to be baptized with, and I am on watch until this is accomplished. You preach peace on earth, but my mission will not bring peace in the material affairs of men, not for a time at least. Division can only be the result when two members of a family believe in me and three members reject this gospel. Friends, relatives, and loved ones are destined to be set against each other by the gospel you preach. True, each of these believers shall have great and lasting peace in his own heart, but peace on earth will not come until all are willing to believe and enter into their glorious inheritance of sonship with God. Nevertheless, go into all the world proclaiming this gospel to all nations, to every man, woman, and child.
Nevertheless, go into the world and set it against itself.
Make it discomfort it. Make it, afflict the comfortable.
Yes, see, nevertheless, go into the world. Oh, he ends on a positive. No. Nevertheless, go into the world, where you are destined to set the world against itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about taking off the rose-colored glasses of being an apostle.
Well, here's that opportunity for me to drop the atheists have a point line. So it's like, gee, look at how religion has set the world against itself these last thousands of years.
That's just evolutionary religion. Wait till you try out direct truth.
Yeah.
See how that sets mankind against itself. Yeah. Before we vamp on that that issue first, let's add another little element of contrast of Luke's accounting of this. And not immediately to the social justice issue in this case, but just more the new wine and old wineskins. So, you think about, especially before he got to, you preach peace on earth part, and division can only be, think about the kind of the character of how he presents these thoughts to the apostles. And you could say, in the wake of him then going on to division and stuff, maybe that brings up hellfire, brimstone and damnation and whatnot, in the apostles' mind, so maybe you can't be too hard on them for putting new wine in old wineskins. But, I thought I'd just read a little chunk in Luke You know, so when Jesus is talking about the parable with the master and the servant, you know, and in Luke, he says that the master, you know, this whole bit of the master coming home unexpected, and the master will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the unbelievers. That servant who knows his master will and does not get ready or does not do what his master wants will be beaten with many blows. But the one who does not know and does not and does things deserving punishment will be beaten with few blows. Okay, so you can have a lot of blows or a few blows. besides being cut to pieces. From everyone who has been given much, much will be demanded. And from the one who has been entrusted with much, much more will be asked. Okay. I have come to bring fire on the earth, and how I wish it were already kindled. But I have a baptism to undergo, and how distressed I am until it is completed. Do you think I came to bring peace on earth? No, I tell you, but division. And it's like, well, okay, kind of, but...
kind of.
See how, it just, like I said, probably the fact that Jesus ended what he did about division, you know, it fueled so much fear in those who were hearing him that the whole thing kind of took on this, anthropomorphic, demonic, scape, demonscape, of hellfire and damnation.
And just as a reminder, this is all being said late at night over a campfire.
Yes, right. shadows flickering and this. yes. The only thing that would have made it more haunting is if it had been in a grotto, right?
right.
Then it could get grotesque. Just notice, even see that little bit, He's not coloring it with social justice, but putting some, once the genuine speech of Jesus, right, when you read something, it's like, Jesus wouldn't say it that way. You know he wouldn't.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, that's like juvenile thinking. Or primitive anyway. You could say it's primitive thinking. Okay? Yeah. So anyway, I thought I'd just bring up that little contrast. But here it is. We finally have gotten to the oft repeated proportion here. The family of five, split two and three, and how this isn't just an arbitrary analogy here. Jesus is giving you a benchmark physics of how the relationship to truth plays out if there aren't mitigating factors. And so this bit of 40%, 60%, 40% find the way of truth, 60% find the way of darkness, starting with the same, in the same state, with the same stimulus. 40% the way of truth, 60% the way of darkness. And everyone should be immediately thinking about, 200,000 years ago, we saw that physics play out precisely. There were 100 primary planetary staff members. Right, Princess corporeal staff, 100 of them precisely, exactly 40 found the way of truth, exactly 60 found the way of darkness.
How curious. Is that how one wonders how universal, how timeless this principle is? Is it a product of rebellion, you know, a benighted sphere? You know, how fundamental is it?
Yeah. Well, and the interesting immediate counterpoint, yeah, see, you know, you don't have any mitigating factor. That's just themselves because they don't have adjusters. But you take the, you know, the upstepped Andonites, the other 100 of the prince's staff, right? That, you know, they're basically the same, except they have adjusters, right? And it almost precisely reciprocates. 44 of those 100 find the way of darkness. 56 find the way of truth. So between having adjusters and, you know, and certainly having mentors, right, a primary, you know, the primary 100, the 40 that, you know, that didn't join the rebellion, that, you know, so those two, you know, additions to the equation, and it almost reciprocated it. The 40-60 the other way.
Sure.
Yeah.
But just a sobering fact of, you know, if you're dealing with just, you know, your relationship to the cosmos, what cosmic tools are you in possession of? Right? No assistance from anyone with a better toolbox. Now, how are you going to fare? Yeah, 40, and it's 60. Sobering. Right. More than 50% will find the way of darkness, thinking that they found the way of truth, remember. Don't simplify this. None of those 60 that found the way of darkness thought they were finding the way of darkness. They thought they were finding the way of truth, and they thought that 40 were off in La La Land.
The villain in the movie never thinks they're the villain.
Right. And it's pretty difficult to tell that Lucifer, you know, or Caligastia, you know, are the villain. I mean, you know, they're so, if we were to see them, like they tell you, right, they're so much more glorious than your imaginings of seeing the Universal Father, you would never question them.
Yeah. They're not twirling their mustaches. There are no horns on them.
Yeah, there's no cloven hooves. There's no fire coming out of their fingertips. Right, no smell of sulfur in the air. No, they're just mind-bogglingly, gloriously spiritual lights. Yeah, so...
That's something.
So, yeah, it's just the fact that, you know, you have this direct... playing out, you know, where you can see, yep, it's 40-60. You know, you think, well, it's probably rounding because we're just only, you know, we're talking about 2/5 and 3/5. It's probably rounded a little bit. It's like, well, we can go to 100 and it's still exactly 40-60.
40.
So it's kind of a few decimal places of precision here.
Makes us grateful for having mercy out there too, not just a terrible swift sword of justice.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, because exactly, and if you know, you should be thankful for grace. See, because without it, yeah, it's the deck is weighted against you, or the die are weighted against you.
Yeah, we'd be,
because the deck is back
hopeless.
And the die are weighted. I'm mixing my metaphors.
gambling metaphors, games of chance. Yeah.
Anyway, it's just so that's an important passage to kind of, you know, to keep in mind of you know, again, just how humble you should be. See, because it's like, no, if you just go with what happens, the natural physics, you know, this is not in your favor here, the odds. So, you know, go slowly, go humbly. And, find that assistance that flips the scale the other way.
Well, I'm going to give Luke a pass on this one. Some of that earlier stuff, maybe not so much, but this one I can imagine the folks he interviewed completely warped this in their memory because there's some heavy stuff here.
No, we'll get back to Luke here in a little bit. But nonetheless, right? No matter what the issue is, just how many ways, an earnest student of the New Testament comes away with a problematic impression of Jesus and his teachings.
Yeah.
They don't know what to do with this.
The tomb of traditional theology. They're like, all right, I guess those are hard sayings that he had. It's pretty hard. Okay.
Yeah, and sort of like, the literalness of that is that it's a tomb. Yeah, like I said, it's new wine and old wineskins, right? Okay. But going forward, right, the truth of Jesus is under a blanket. That's why I kind of flipped the analogy when you were talking about it at the beginning of the show. You need to take those coverings off, right? And have the truth revealed to you again, to drop the veil, right, that's preventing you from getting to the truth of Jesus' teachings.
I have one really quick point. The second to last sentence in that paragraph, Chris, how the sequence of it, how it starts with, true, each of these believers shall have great and lasting peace in his own heart. That's the Father inner life. And then, but peace on earth will not come until all are willing to believe and enter into their glorious inheritance of sonship with God. That's the mother totality attitude that you referenced, and it follows that exact same sequence that you spoke of before in the previous arc.
Right. The first part, you can see this back in paper 16, section 6. The first part is, okay, so you've got the kindred spirit thing. You've got the potential. Right? But you don't get peace on earth until you have kindred minds.
Right. There you go. Back to that, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. It's the same. Yeah, it's just paralleling that, saying that same thing in a different way. It's a wonderful starting point, recognition of, and the hope tied to that, the literalness of that potentiality, right, that you can have mutual recognition of a great and lasting peace in your own hearts, but if you're honest with yourself, you know that what you're really looking for is a little bit more of an outer life manifestation, right? And that doesn't happen by everyone just clicking their ruby red slippers. And wishing for it.
Yeah. Right.
Again, and that this was cosmic machinery. That's what they're saying. You see, everyone has to have the cosmic machinery so they can be kindred minds. Okay, and then you have peace on earth.
Takes a long time.
Yeah. I mean, you don't initially appreciate that, it's like, well, no, it just says enter into their glorious inheritance of sonship with God. It's like, you have to take delight in cultivating in order to acquire that inheritance. It isn't just plopped into your bank account.
Right, you have to receive it, yes.
Yes, and you have to take possession of that. It's in your free will domain, right? So, can be imposed upon you, really.
And this was the end of a full and busy Sabbath day. On the morrow, Jesus and the 12 went into the cities of northern Perea to visit with the 70, who were working in these regions under Abner's supervision.
We are going to get back to the fact that we're supposedly talking about, the Perean mission here.
Not just one Saturday long ago, yeah. There's a lot of pages about this one day.
Yeah. But again, it just, it's they're going to emphasize this as we start reading the next paper. The actual direct engagement of others, of the mission, you know, per se, is in the hands of the 70 under Abner's supervision, not, you know, not in the hands of the 12 under Jesus' supervision.
Right.
So the process of evolving this from the immediacy of Jesus' micromanagement is well in, you know, in play already.
Yeah.
Management by wandering around is what we've got full bore now. Literally. Okay, Justin, would you like to take us on into the next paper, continue the reading?
Sure, Brad, thanks. Paper 166, Last Visit to Northern Perea. From February 11 to 20, Jesus and the 12 made a tour of all the cities and villages of Northern Perea where the associates of Abner and the members of the Women's Corps were working. They found these messengers of the gospel meeting with success, and Jesus repeatedly called the attention of his apostles to the fact that the gospel of the kingdom could spread without the accompaniment of miracles and wonders. This entire mission,
Before you do the next paragraph, just one little quick comment. You know, just again, you know, ask yourself, okay, why did they burn a whole paragraph to say that, right? I mean, is that just facts? Is this a part of the book that isn't a revelation of truth? the more prosaic it seems, the more you want to sort of very consciously pause between paragraphs, as it were, and it's like, okay, look at them re-stressing that, that Jesus was re-stressing it, so the midwayers are re-stressing it. He repeatedly called the attention of his apostles to the fact the gospel of the kingdom could spread without the accompaniment of miracles and wonders.
Yes.
I wonder if the Urantia book could spread.
That's a tantalizing way to put it. Yeah.
How much do we just fall into that national book? Did you hear the story about the loaves and the fishes? It's even better than in the New Testament.
The one I was comparing the wedding feast at Cana right at the beginning of the whole thing, what the Urantia book says versus what's in Luke, I believe, and therefore it gets dramatized. It's like, well, there's a much better story of that wedding feast there. There's like power beings involved. You know that?
right.
Yeah. It's not just the rocks that obey him; it's the rocks' bosses that obey him.
Yeah. Oh my.
So again, we need to kind of, you know, poke at ourselves a little bit like this and laugh, you know, nervously. But okay, can we challenge ourselves to not just put new wine in old wineskins again, right? And have it all be about the miracles and wonders.
It's hard. It is very. It's much more difficult to draw a vivid illustration of Jesus teaching a philosophic point than people partying when wine's drawn out of water pots. I mean, one of those paints itself almost, the other one does not.
Especially if the moment he goes away from miracles and wonders, he starts challenging the fundamental principles of progressivism. Now that is blasphemy.
We don't like that.
Yes, this is the problem.
This entire mission of 3 months in Perea was successfully carried on with little help from the 12 apostles. And the gospel from this time on reflected not so much Jesus' personality as his teachings. But his followers did not long follow his instructions. For soon after Jesus' death and resurrection, they departed from his teachings and began to build the early church around the miraculous concepts and the glorified memories of his divine human personality.
Yeah, as we often point out, on the day of Pentecost, they headed off on this tangent like they're describing here, and they described it as a mistake. as evil.
That should underscore, Chris, the nature of spirit energy in a malapplied way. The spirit of truth just jacked those guys way up. Said they made more personal spiritual progress in a few in months or than the whole time they'd been with him. So they were really under the influence, so to speak. Drunk
just,
with the spirit.
Yeah, they're drunk with the spirit, quote unquote. And it's just and your natural tendency is to take all that new spiritualization and not apply it to something originative, right? Behold, all things are becoming new, but to apply it to the old and give it, increased energy. Right? I mean, it's like, they said, you think you know the atonement doctrine. Wait till we tell you this new spiritualized version of the atonement doctrine.
Right.
This isn't your father's atonement doctrine. See, that's what they did, right? They used all that additional spiritualization in their old wineskins to just take the old and make it all the more problematic. And certainly to carry it beyond its evolutionary validity. Right? All good things taken to extreme combat. Right? I mean, the atonement, sin, sacrifice, and atonement has its proper place in the evolutionary process. But eventually, you got to move on. And again, I can say, what about the Urantia book? Not so much Jesus' personality as his teachings. It's like, but Jesus is the most used word in the Urantia book, so it's got to be about Jesus' personality and not his teachings. The word cloud tells us so.
The illustrations we bolt alongside our enhanced versions of it tell us so.
All right, it's so natural. He was a cool personality. So the more directly you know him instead of through the fog of the New Testament, the more difficult this will be, right? To say, Jesus was a cool personality. Let's consider, the philosophic ramifications of, some of what we gained from his teachings via synthesis. And everyone's going, whatever. It's very difficult. It's not natural to want to set, his glorious personality aside. And it has its place. It's an attention step. It should spark you, right? Oh, that is fantastic. I want to be like that. Right? I want to have the faith of Jesus.
Right.
Not I want to worship the faith of Jesus. I want to have the faith of Jesus. Right? It's like flipping it so that it's my will that your will be done instead of not my will but your will be done.
Yeah.
Bring yourself into play. Challenge yourself. Recognize, what you have to challenge yourself and what responsibilities you have. Those sorts of things, rather than just, leaning on him. I'm with him. You got to do more than that. Yeah.
Comes back to the of all human knowledge, once again, that which is of the greatest value.
Yeah.
But not in a fetishistic way, see? That's the challenge.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely thinking of religion as personal spiritual experience. Section 1, the Pharisees at Ragabah. On Sabbath, February 18, Jesus was at Ragabah where there lived a wealthy Pharisee named Nathanael. And since quite a number of his fellow Pharisees were following Jesus and the 12 around the country, he made a breakfast on this Sabbath morning for all of them, about 20 in number, and invited Jesus as the guest of honor.
All right, so, I mean, just the only thing I need to say there is they're helping us to precisely know where to turn to in the Gospels for a parallel to this. And we'll see as we get into it a little bit why they need to give you a very specific prologue like that, because there's potential for confusion with other breakfasts with the Pharisees, other times when he gets into the mode he's about to get into.
Yeah.
Okay. So they need to get you precisely focused so that it helps to clarify, not only where you need to look for a parallel, but how those who wrote the New Testament, years later were confused and got things blurred together.
Yeah.
By the time Jesus arrived at this breakfast, most of the Pharisees, with two or three lawyers, were already there and seated at the table. The master immediately took his seat at the left of Nathanael without going to the water basins to wash his hands. Many of the Pharisees, especially those favorable to Jesus' teachings, knew that he washed his hands only for purposes of cleanliness, that he abhorred these purely ceremonial performances, so they were not surprised at his coming directly to the table without having twice washed his hands. But Nathanael was shocked by this failure of the master to comply with the strict requirements of Pharisaic practice. Neither did Jesus wash his hands, as did the Pharisees, after each course of food, nor at the end of the meal.
And then you break out the lotion because your hands are getting so dry and shaved. We apparently had no Pharisees, within hearing, because I didn't hear any gasps, Justin read without going to the water basins to wash his hands. Sacrilege.
He must have done it once, because they say without having twice washed his hands. So he probably cleaned himself up, and that was enough.
No, he immediately took his seat at the left, without going to the water basin to wash his hands.
So yeah, he didn't even wash.
Right. Yeah, he just went
once.
Straight to the table. Dual sacrilege, right? If you will, right? Hmm. Not only did he not wash him once? Yeah, twice. He didn't even wash him once. But this all seems a bit silly, of course, to us these days. In its specificity. But if you philosophically recognize what's going on, it has nothing but relevance to thoughts that you have all over in your head. All right, this is about purity. Not lack of dirt under your fingernails kind of purity, cleanliness. All right, it's not that kind of cleanliness. It's so-called holy cleanliness. It's that kind of purity. Right? And this, natural tendency we have to want purity, that's extremely relevant to every thought you get in your head, because every thought you get in your head now, because we're more spiritual, gets immediately kind of washed in with that spiritual energization, and naturally that gives you an instinct for purity in that area. The only way you're not going to have that is if you're unnaturally overruling that tendency. So no matter how secular the issue, you'll go to purity right out of the starting gate, you know, with it.
And you
that's
you,
a problem.
And you can
what's
see
a, what's
how...
A con-
go ahead, Carmen. Go ahead.
I was just wondering what a contemporary illustration of that would look like.
Yeah, well, if we get too secular, we're immediately going to be quite controversial.
We
yeah. At this point, so we don't get too distracted, right, just consider that, right? And you know, the next time that you feel very opinionated about something, the when you were, you know, if you were kind of old school, you'd go, by God, such and so, right? Remember, we have a term that comes from, you know, people saying, by God, it's called bigot.
Hmm.
Right? That's what bigot means. It means that person that goes, mm-hmm. by God, that's not pure. Catch yourself. Right? That's the natural tendency. When you get fired up about something, and you're like, well, you know, that's not appropriate. Ask yourself, well, what am I doing, and what's the issue? Why am I thinking that's not appropriate? Very often you'll go, oh, that's my primitive religious tendency. I'm thinking that's not, you know, we've got this thing that we're treating religiously, and then people who don't follow it precisely they're not pure. See, and you've got to get that out of there. I mean, there may be some scientific, practical issues that are appropriate to consider, but the moment you bring in that, unwittingly bring in that purity instinct, that primitive religious instinct, you're going to get all muddled up about it. You won't be able to think about it genuinely scientifically anymore.
Hmm.
You're turning it into an evolutionary religion. And it's you know, every ideology, every ism out there, you know, has its purity police. It doesn't matter what ism you pick, you know. And like I've said many times, these days the most trivial idea is immediately turned into an ism, you know, with a purity
mm-hmm.
police. The most trivial things.
Chris, I appreciate you trying to keep us above the specifics. You know, my mind is going directly to some specifics that grab me, and I'm not going to repeat them here because I know what will happen is, you know, we might even get a caller, which we don't often do, who would dispute my thoughts about this and that, and I'm just like, everywhere.
We're not here to demonize, you know, ourselves or anyone else. Okay,
right.
We're all these natural children of God. The Ratchet Book is trying to help us understand our natural temperament in this more spiritualized state now, 2,000 years hence from Jesus' time. Just what's natural? What's the natural physics of children of God now? Okay, and it's full of problems, right, that you've got to start becoming conscious of and maturing beyond.
Yeah.
No one is damning you for any of these things or anything. Just catch yourself doing it. Oh, wait, no, I'm doing that again. I'm getting that all, you know, religiousized. That's not a religious issue. Religion is a personal spiritual experience in my inner life, and this is a totally outer life issue.
I can't help but think of the significance of when you have that third cosmic intuition sort of firing off out of coordination with the other two. I can't help but think of how important it is that personality harmonize and coordinate all three.
Yeah. Again, when I say, when Kermit read that thing about the self-gratification being more spiritually energized now, you know, than it used to be. See, again, more and more, you're not just zealous, you're fanatical. It's just like,
yeah.
Oh, thank you, universe. Thank you for making that natural. I was having a hard enough time with zeal. Now you're making it so I'm going to immediately want to have a tendency to go fanatical with it, and I have to overcome that. And they say, yeah, to him whom much is given is much expected. Oh.
And nothing's going to coordinate that outside of personality, Chris, is that correct, in terms of finding that balance and harmony in those reality responses? Personality is
it's the potential
harmonizing
to
influence.
Encompass it and produce a coordination within.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, the personality is just the potential for it. Right. You've got to actualize the cosmic machinery within, and that's your synchronization with the mother, not the father.
I'll read one more paragraph and then go ahead.
Yeah,
sorry.
I'm really eager to hear how you read this next paragraph.
After considerable whispering between Nathaniel and an unfriendly Pharisee on his right, and after much lifting of eyebrows and sneering curling of lips by those who sat opposite the master, Jesus finally said, I had thought that you invited me to this house to break bread with you and perchance to inquire of me concerning the proclamation of the new gospel of the kingdom of God. But I perceive that you have brought me here to witness an exhibition of ceremonial devotion to your own self-righteousness. That service you have now done me, what next will you honor me with as your guest on this occasion?
Well,
drip, drip, drip. I think we call that dripping with sarcasm.
A rare moment, a rare moment in the fifth epical revelation.
Boy.
Jesus is going, okay, this is getting just completely tedious. My life is almost done here. I'm going to just use sarcasm.
Yeah. There's...
If this was a movie, he would have looked at the camera and actually given us a look of like,
yes. Right.
What next will you? Oh, man.
I can't wait. What's for dessert? Yeah.
Yeah. So we all know we're supposed to, you know, not immediately go to sarcasm, especially with the least among us. But yeah, there is a place for it, right? He's with the Pharisees. They're over the top tedious, and he just lets them have it. And they're all checking their shoelaces after that, or their sandal straps, right?
Yeah.
I couldn't help but focus on the lifting of eyebrows and the sneering curling of lips.
Yeah.
I tried to envision that. What does that look like? We need a GIF for that one.
Well, Kermit, would you like to take on the reading?
Sure, thanks.
And before you do, Kermit, just the lifting eyebrows, sneering, curling of the lips. I mean, see, you don't get such a physiological manifestation, a grotesque physiological manifestation, unless they're seriously using spiritual energy to push their mind about this material triviality.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, you just, your mind dominates your body, but just the mind in and of itself only pushes the body so far. Right? If you want to really contort your body, you have to inappropriately use the energy of the upper domain of your mind, your spiritualized mind, to further drive that lower domain to drive your body. Right? You know, there's that physiological consequence of feeling emotion, the motion out, the emotion. But you can amp that emotion up, that outward motion, that physiological consequence. If you bring in, the body is more contorted when you're fanatical than when you're merely zealous.
Good point.
Yeah, that's a fair point. I took it more mild. I thought it was more on just the level of social virtue signaling.
Oh,
like,
it
who
is,
can look
of
the
course.
Most disgusted?
Okay. Yeah, obviously. I mean, right.
Who can outdo who?
Right. I mean, you know, they all may just be looking at each other. You know, my lip is curling more than yours. Right. Okay, sure. Okay, but... but, you know, but to see play off of that, I mean, you
I
know,
see your
man, just, you know, like, to keep, you know, keep on what we're saying. This is what's in store for you if you don't bring your spiritualization into check. You know, it will just drive you to extremes in every way, shape, and literally form of your body.
Yeah.
When the master had thus spoken, they cast their eyes upon the table and remained silent. And since no one spoke, Jesus continued, "Many of you Pharisees are here with me as friends. Some are even my disciples. But the majority of the Pharisees are persistent in their refusal to see the light and acknowledge the truth, even when you think the work of the gospel is brought before them in great power. How carefully you cleanse the outside of your cups and platters, while the spiritual food vessels are filthy and polluted. You make sure to present a pious and holy appearance to the people, but your inner souls are filled with self-righteousness, covetousness, extortion, and all manner of spiritual wickedness. Your leaders even dare to plot and plan the murder of the Son of Man. Do not you foolish men understand that the God of heaven looks at the inner motives of the soul as well as on your outer pretenses and your pious professions? Think not that the giving of alms and the paying of tithes will cleanse you from unrighteousness and enable you to stand clean in the presence of the judge of all men. Woe upon you, Pharisees, who have persisted in rejecting the light of life. You are meticulous in tithing and ostentatious in almsgiving, but you knowingly spurn the visitation of God and reject the revelation of his love. Though it is all right for you to give attention to these minor duties, you should not have left these weightier requirements undone. Woe upon all who shun justice, spurn mercy, and reject truth. Woe upon all those who despise the revelation of the Father while they seek the chief seats in the synagogue and crave flattering salutations in the marketplaces." Whoa.
Whoa. Yes, to coin a phrase. Okay, so even the novice is probably thinking, "Oh, yeah, I remember about Jesus getting into, 'Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites that you are.'" But this doesn't seem to be that. What's going on? Yeah, this is, you know, as things got written down long after, this little bout of woe upon you got mixed up with the other main bout of woe upon you to the Pharisees.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? The last temple discourse.
Yeah.
Right.
That's right.
This was warm-up.
Yeah, this was a warm-up. And many of the things that he said in the last temple discourse, you know, he tried them out here first. He kind of repeated some of these things, which made it even more likely that the two incidents would get kind of blurred together. You know, and the subsequent gospel writers, you know, would get confused about, you know, how this works. In Luke, right, this bunch of woes comes before what we were just reading instead of after, because Luke is tying it up with what's in Matthew 23, you know, which is, there, Matthew is paralleling the last temple discourse, and it's close.
Yeah, all right.
Right, and you can see how Luke, you know, worded a number of the things that he, you know, in his, you know, set of woes, you know, to just match up with the different way that Jesus said it, you know, in the last temple discourse, and the way Matthew recounts it, because Luke is looking at Matthew's, you know, record.
Yeah.
Okay, so you give Luke, you know, it's you can't fault him too much. for that measure of confusion. And so, you know, when you see some of the differences between what's in the Urantia book here and what's in chapter 11 of Luke, it's like, you know, you can understand those differences. They have a lot to do with, you know, it being tied back to Matthew 23 and the Last Temple Discourse. It's like, okay, all fine and dandy. However, there is a specific Luke thing that we should hold up. Right. So before the first literal woe upon you there, that sentence, kind of in the middle of what we were reading there, where it says, think not that the giving of alms and the paying of tithes will cleanse you from unrighteousness and enable you to stand clean in the presence of the judge of all men.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what's Luke's sentence immediately prior to that first direct woe upon you?
I have a suspicion of where this is going.
Luke says, but give what is inside the dish to the poor, and everything will be clean for you.
Clean it up. Just give it away. You can clean it up.
Oh, wow.
I think we
were at
180 degrees, weren't we?
Yeah.
And that's think not that the giving of alms and the paying of tithes will cleanse you. And Luke says the exact opposite.
That's got Luke's fingerprints on it more than anyone he might have interviewed, I would say.
Right. See, that's why the midwares are holding that up. Right. It's the mustard seed for taking the proper outer life practical issues that can be put under the banner of social justice and dealt with appropriately with material pragmatism and whatnot, right? It's injecting this spiritual energy into it. And so even when our society begins to completely leave the Bible behind, right, and don't seem to be basing what they're doing at all on what Luke said, they are. With the fallacy that of the mustard seed that Luke planted in our civilization, right, where you then start to conclude that social justice has a domain beyond what's appropriate, and you think that social injustice, for instance, is the cause of human inequality.
After all, Jesus said so, or he hinted at it. Luke reports him as saying it.
Yes.
Yeah.
See, this is the fail. Right? Budding social justice warrior named Luke is causing problems.
I have a question about the use of the word self-righteousness up above
mm-hmm.
there.
Yep.
Versus unrighteousness.
Unrighteousness.
We've talked before about righteousness being conformity with the cosmos. I was wondering if you could maybe just take a few minutes to, is self-righteousness sort of conformity with oneself and unrighteousness a lack of conformity with the cosmos? Or can you maybe look at those two words a little bit?
So you start with the positive fact of righteousness is conformity with the cosmos. And then you could say, well, okay, so theoretically, I could think in contrast to that, and I'd call the contrasting concept unrighteousness. It's like, okay. So that's contemplating it in the negative. It's like, well, no, okay, but now positively, what do I mean positively by unrighteousness, you know, philosophically positively, by unrighteousness? Well, you can use a term that is direct instead of negating, like unrighteousness. A synonym is wickedness. Unrighteousness is wickedness. Okay, it's like, well, all right. Well, okay, so it's, I could be wicked. Okay, you know, and this is sort of an active state that I'm in. I'm not just not righteous. Okay. But I'm actively wicked. It's like, well, okay, but if righteousness is conformity to the cosmos, wickedness is conformity to what? Your exalted self.
Yeah, self, right.
Right, it's self-righteousness.
And all three of those words are used.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Yes.
All right.
Just thinking it through like that. Yeah, so anyway, yeah. So that was another Luke's greatest hits.
I wouldn't have done any better.
When Jesus...
I would have put my own spin on this. I would have. I had the same problem. I was the secretary of a nonprofit board for a while, and I got to take all the notes of the meetings. And at the time, I'm like, well, I get to put my own sort of spin on this as I'm condensing down what everyone said. What a cool way to exert an influence. Like, and I thought
that's
that was
right.
Great.
Yeah, that's not the seeds of self-righteousness or anything. Yeah, no problem there at all.
When Jesus would have risen to depart, one of the lawyers who was at the table addressing him said, "But Master, in some of your statements you reproach us also. Is there nothing good in the scribes, the Pharisees, or the lawyers?" And Jesus, standing, replied to the lawyer, "You, like the Pharisees, delight in the first places at the feasts and in wearing long robes, while you put heavy burdens, grievous to be borne, on men's shoulders. And when the souls of men stagger under these heavy burdens, you will not so much as lift with one of your fingers. Woe upon you who take your greatest delight in building tombs for the prophets your fathers killed, and that you consent to what your fathers did is made manifest when you now plan to kill those who come in this day doing what the prophets did in their day, proclaiming the righteousness of God and revealing the mercy of the Heavenly Father. But of all the generations that are past, the blood of the prophets and the apostles shall be required of this perverse and self-righteous generation. Woe upon all of you lawyers who have taken away the key of knowledge from the common people. You yourselves refuse to enter into the way of truth, and at the same time you would hinder all others who seek to enter therein. But you cannot thus shut up the doors of the kingdom of heaven. These we have opened to all who have the faith to enter, and these portals of mercy shall not be closed by the prejudice and arrogance of false teachers and untrue shepherds, who are like whited sepulchres, which, while outwardly they appear beautiful, are inwardly full of dead men's bones and all manner of spiritual uncleanness.
What a party.
There it is, the sophistry analogy, right? You know, the spiritual candy painted on the outside, yes.
The poor lawyer who dared ask that question probably wanted to reconsider it.
Yeah,
like,
Jesus,
so
remember,
you're saying,
like they said,
no.
It's standing when he's doing this now, even more ominous.
Yeah. Let him go.
The woes just keep coming. Right, so, how wonderful it is to have this, you know, basically restored like this, you know, in contrast to the, you know, the muddled, limited thing, you know, in Luke. It's all here in all of its, you know, ominous glory, you know, including, right, where it gets quite ominous, but of all the generations that are past, the blood of the prophets and the apostles shall be required of this perverse and self-righteous generation.
Not far off. Yep.
Right.
And it wasn't.
Yeah. The crosses of crucified Jews are about to litter the hillsides and the roads as far as the eye can see in every direction.
Yeah, and he forecasts the apostles' end as well here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those times when we've seen that before, where he knows how this is going to play out, when the Most Highs withdraw the hand, you know, of mitigation, and the Romans have free rein to you know, do something about this tedious problem they have.
Trying to remember, I don't know the Bible well enough. Do we get the line specifically toward lawyers, or was it all directed toward Pharisees? He carves out a little time here about knowledge with the lawyers.
Yeah. I mean, woe to you experts in the law, for instance.
Yeah, right.
Because you have taken away the key to knowledge. Yeah. So, yeah, that distinction's there.
And it's still with
us. And?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah.
And
insert your favorite joke about lawyers. Yes.
Okay, guys, are we ready to go?
Yeah, go for it.
And when Jesus had finished speaking at Nathanael's table, he went out of the house without partaking of food. And of the Pharisees who heard these words, some became believers in his teaching and entered into the kingdom. But the larger number persisted in the way of darkness, becoming all the more determined to lie in wait for him, that they might catch some of his words which could be used to bring him to trial and judgment before the Sanhedrin at Jerusalem.
In the Luke passage ends with the essence of that paragraph there, that little footnote paragraph. But see what the midwayers gave us, this great little contrasting pair of phrases. And in that final woe, we got the way of truth. And here, in contrast, the way of darkness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's why I was using that, two of the five in the family find the way of truth. Three, unfortunately, find the way of darkness. But the larger numbers, so you notice that too, see?
Yes.
But the larger number persisted in the way of darkness.
More than 50%.
Even with Jesus' help, right? That prior mathematics is in play.
Yeah.
Right?
There were just three things to which the Pharisees paid particular attention. One, the practice of strict tithing. Two, scrupulous observance of the laws of purification. And three, avoidance of association with all non-Pharisees.
Okay, so scientifically there's three things. Okay, but philosophically there's one concept. Purity. Right? The middle one there speaks directly of laws of purification.
Yeah.
Right? But it's all about purity. Right? I mean, purity and tithing. You pick some material issue. Okay, and we're talking, the practice of strict tithing. Okay, so if they grow herbs in their garden, the Pharisees, they tithe a tenth of their garden herbs.
Right.
It's purity, see? Right? It goes beyond, some sort of scientific determination of effective, almsgiving to help the poor, blah, 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 blah. No. It's purity, really, fundamentally.
Chris, is that same impulse that's driving these Pharisees towards purity similar to the impulse that has driven other cultures to countless rituals throughout all of human history, this concept of being sort of stuck in the ritual?
Obviously, each of them comes up with their own kind of folkway ritual, what's kind of natural for them genetically, some ritual. Okay, but then after the ritual is established, then it's about being pure relative to that ritual. And so it takes on a life of its own.
Yeah.
Right? The ritual exists not with its initial concept, but just an end in itself as a means, a means and an end for purity.
Yeah.
Look how precisely I do this ritual, unlike those people over there that, missed step two.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, no, you turn left at the altar, not right.
Right.
God, right? It's an abomination. Purity. It's all about purity.
One thought I just had here, I chafed a little bit when I reread this little block, this paragraph recently, and it's because I felt like, isn't that a little too stereotypical, too broad of a brushstroke? What about Nicodemus? Like, not every Pharisee was exactly the same, but I think what they're doing here is they're talking about the Pharisaic culture, the culture of the Pharisaic way of being. And yes, there were outliers and some who said, I don't want any more of this, but this was their culture. This is what you signed up for as a Pharisee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's, the code.
That's your starting point, you know, and it's all, you know, you have a subset of people who have that genetic temperament. And they all collect in a bin.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they're happy as clams in mud. Right? Right? And they can have their poor man's unity, right? Their uniformity, and it's ever more refined, pure, and more pure. Right? Yeah. And, you know, that's just, you know, that's what people do, right? They pool in their genetic bins of temperament, you know, and seek the ends of purity therein. And they call it righteousness, right? Righteousness is what I do. I tithe strictly. That's righteousness. I scrupulously observe the laws of purification. That's righteousness, et cetera.
Yeah. At this time, Jesus sought to expose the spiritual barrenness of the first two practices, while he reserved his remarks designed to rebuke the Pharisees' refusal to engage in social intercourse with non-Pharisees for another and subsequent occasion when he would again be dining with many of these same men. I dare say some of these same men were probably witness to his last temple discourse, you think?
Yeah, they were. Of course they were. You know, and they're you know, in there whipping up the crowd, you know, crucify him, and whatnot. Okay, see, so we'll in this arc, we'll get to that follow-on breakfast. Right? He's dining with them again. But, you know, again, notice the opportunity. You know, they just tee it up for you. At this time, Jesus sought to expose the spiritual barrenness. Okay, now don't think of that in an old school way. It doesn't mean that, yeah, these are spiritual things we're talking about, but they're not appropriate spiritual things. It's like, no, they're not spiritual at all. That's what they mean by spiritual barrenness. This is purely material stuff. There's rearranging molecules and calling it spiritual. Right? It's not even a religion of mind. It's a religion of matter.
Matter, right. Right.
Yeah.
Has nothing to do with what is genuinely spiritual. Right? And it doesn't matter how many millennia of sanctification there is behind some of these things. You know, and how they've been morphed into a new understanding that's more of the religion of the mind than of the, of matter, right? You know, and are fully theologically sanctioned in Christendom or whatever. Okay, this isn't anything to do with spiritual. You know, at what point do we recognize that and seek the higher rather than the exaltation of the lesser?
Yeah.
The more things change, the more they stay the same. Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah. Right. Again, we don't tend to call too many subsets Pharisees these days, but we might recognize if they're Pharisaic in genetic temperament.
Right. Right.
Like, oh, yeah, those are the same genetic temperaments. Right? They just have a different cultural context that they've stuck themselves in.
Right.
Right, the folkway is different, so the specifics are different, but in essence, it's the same.
And if you give them power in your society and your culture, well, woe unto you, because they can begin to steer the whole thing awry. Well,
yeah, and imagine if you totally divorce their doings from God and make it purely secular.
Hmm.
All right.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Yeah. Whoa.
That's
WHOA, right?
Exactly. That's what I meant. And that's the note we'll have to leave it on. We're out of time. Great study. Justin, thank you for being here. Thank you all for being here. We'll see you next time. Follow the way.
Take care, everyone.
God bless all.
Yes, indeed. Follow the way of truth. Take care, everyone. Bye now.